sigue aprendiendo, disfrutando. Este verano sigue conectado con Vaughan Radio. Well, I found a woman stronger than anyone I know. She shares my dreams. I hope that someday I'll share her home. I found the love to carry more than just my secrets, to carry love, to carry children of our own. Este verano sigue conectado con Vaughan Radio. Este verano no abandones tu inglés.
Welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and on tonight's program, well, I'll begin by talking about an incident from the Bible. This incident will illustrate something that I'm going to talk about later, something that I'm going to talk about in connection with the Knights Templar. Remember, on last night's program, I spoke about the Knights Templar, but I did not speak about their end, their dissolution, how it all worked out. I didn't mention that. It was in the Tintero. It was still in the inkwell. In fact, I ran out of time. But tonight, I will talk about the end of the Templars, and in order to do that, I'm going to talk about something from the Bible, a moment from the Old Testament, a moment from the book of Exodus. Now, you remember that Moses, the author, let's call it that, of the Exodus, of the escape from Egypt into the Sinai Desert. Moses, responsible for the 40 years of travel around the Sinai before entering into the Promised Land, Moses had a brother and a sister. The brother's name was Aaron, and he was much better at speaking than Moses. Moses didn't speak very well. He didn't have a public persona. He kept telling God that he was not the right vehicle and that you needed a spokesperson. You needed what we call a front man. You needed a PR person to actually deal with the people. And that was going to be his brother, Aaron, who was much more eloquent, much more personable, with a greater level of emotional intelligence, as we would say today. And so that was his brother. His sister, older sister, the eldest child, Miriam. Evidently, Miriam was there when Moses' mother put him into the Nile. Remember that she got rid of the baby. She allowed the baby to float down the Nile, where he was picked up by the daughter of the Pharaoh. Supposedly, well, this is not part of the Bible, but the oral tradition has it that Miriam actually saw this and followed the baby, or rather followed the floating basket down through the Nile and saw how he was picked up and cared for. In any case, Miriam being perhaps the more sensible one, and Aaron being the personality, the public relations. In any case, At one point, it is time to receive the law. And Moses goes up on the mountain. Now, the Bible, at least the early books in the Bible, are a mixture of traditions. Specifically, the northern tribes, the ones we call Israel, the northern tribes had a completely different tradition, a completely different understanding from the southern tribes, the area around Judea. Now, Israel and Judea, they got together under King David. They were there under King Solomon. They broke up. And the northern state was obliterated by the Assyrians. That was the end. Only the vestige of that was the Samaritans later. But their understanding, their differences, well, all of these are manifest in the Bible, usually with two different stories. For example, the creation of Adam. In one case, it's male and female. He created them, right? They're created together, Adam and Eve. And in another tradition, the southern tradition, Adam comes out of, or rather Eve comes out of Adam's rib. She is created from part of Adam. Now, this is a completely different understanding. And all of this was discovered in the 19th century, figured out. And it is very, very interesting to compare which section of the Bible comes from which part. In any case, the mountain that Moses goes up to is Horeb in one tradition and Sinai in the other. So yes, they don't agree on which mountain he went up. Now, when he went up, oh, by the way, this is another story about the Bible, translation. When Moses came back down off the mountain, in the original, in Hebrew, they talk about a glow on his face, so that he came down from the mountain with a kind of a radiant expression on his face, a glow. Well, that in the original translation to Latin, I believe that Saint Jerome is responsible for this, but it was a big mistake. It was translated not as a glow, not as a resplendor or anything like that. No, it was translated as horns. And yeah, so Moses comes down off the mountain with horns on his face. And, I imagine, you know, the Vulgate version was adopted as sacred and unquestionable, right? Orthodoxy, unquestionable, adopted from the beginning. And so when it became obvious that this was a mistaken translation, well, you just couldn't admit it. Nobody wants to admit that there is a mistake, because then you would have to re-examine the entire thing, and nobody wanted to do that. And so, what do? You insist that what Moses really had were horns on his head. And so, yes, you go to the Vatican today, and you will see the sculpture of Michelangelo with Moses and horns on his head, although everybody knew at the time that this was a simple mistake in translation. Nobody was going to admit it. Well, in any case, Moses goes up the mountain, and he's gone for a long, long time. And his people down below simply go crazy. They start running wild. They are out of control. They are a laughing stock. That's afme reir, a laughing stock to their enemies. And God tells Moses, go back down, your people. Your people are out of control. And he does. And there he sees that his own brother, mediating with the people, trying to find a compromise, right, a negotiation, something, a cession, no, 50-50. That's the English meaning of the word compromise. Comprometerse in English is to commit. Compromise is llegar a un acuerdo cediendo. And so any negotiation involves compromise. And Aaron, the high priest, Aaron, the spokesperson, Aaron, the one who actually had to deal with the people, he decided that it was going to be necessary to have an image, that you cannot you cannot venerate nothing. You have to have something. And so they melted down the little gold they had. You know, people were wearing, I don't know, decoration, jewelry, things like that. And they melted it down, and they had a golden calf. That's what we call it in English. El becerro de oro is the golden calf. And so here they were singing to the golden calf, which is just completely it's just not like the kind of religion that the temple in Jerusalem was trying to impose on the people. Now, Moses was furious, absolutely furious, and his punishment was telling the people, the men, to pick up their swords, pick up any arms they had, go through the camp, and kill. Everybody kill a brother or a friend. And in the end, about 3,000 people were killed. This was the this was considered an adequate punishment for the golden calf, that transgression. And Moses, who hadn't finished in his conversations with God, went back up the mountain, spoke to God, said, "This should be enough. My people aren't that bad." God said, "Yes, they are. I will punish sin." And so that wasn't enough. A plague, peste, a plague descended on the camp. And so, yes, these people were in real trouble for the golden calf. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is precisely what the king of France, Felipe el Hermoso, Philip the Fair, this is precisely the justification that he used, biblical justification, for his punishment of the Knights Templars. Now, as you remember from the program yesterday, at a certain moment, the civil authorities descended simultaneously all over France, and they arrested the members of the Knights Templar that they could find, because naturally, the Knights Templar knew about this beforehand. It's not as if they didn't have information, sources of information. It's not as if they didn't have spies. They were, like I say, a state within a state. They were a church within the church. They controlled everything. They were smart. In any case, they knew it was coming. And so quite a lot of the Knights Templar escaped, although many of them stayed, and these were the ones arrested, including the important ones, including the decision makers. Now, these people were, of course, tortured, and under torture, they confessed to all kinds of things. And naturally, because the Knights Templar were directly answerable to the Pope, this all belonged under ecclesiastical jurisdiction. When they were turned over to the church, they immediately recanted. They immediately said, no, I didn't mean that. They said that was a simple question of extortion, of torture, of what do they call it? The United States enhanced interrogation methods. And so any testimony under enhanced interrogation methods is really invalid. Just not true. And so the Pope at the time, Clement the Fifth, he was in Philip's pocket, but Philip actually pretty much forced him to move closer to France, to move to Avignon, which at the time wasn't actually part of France, but close enough, certainly closer than Rome. In any case, Clement V, who did not dare to, no se atrevía, he did not dare to contradict or contravene anything that Philip was doing. He believed that these people should stay under ecclesiastical jurisdiction. He didn't want to force the point, but, well, it was enough. Philip got angry and believed that Clement was being disloyal. And this was the idea. You're going to pay for this. He began to tell stories about Clement the Fifth and bad things that Clement the Fifth had done. But the fact is that, compared to other popes, compared to the clergy at the time, what did he do? Fornication, sodomy, simony, right? The sale of office so that bishops had to pay money to become bishop? No, none of that. No, nepotism. That was the charge. That was the accusation, that he practiced nepotism. Who doesn't practice nepotism? Who hasn't done that? Unconvincing. And so this is when Philip started talking about this precedent from the Bible, from Exodus, when Moses comes down from the mountain and intervenes, takes things away from Aaron. Aaron being the ecclesiastical authority and Moses being the divine authority. In this case, the civil authority. And so, yes, comparing himself to Moses. This is what Philip did. In any case, the problem was solving itself. Because of the repeated torture and the conditions in which they were held, many of the Knights Templar were simply dying anyway. So, in many cases, there was no trial. In addition to which, a confession, which you later retract, is actually a sign that you have relapsed, that you have fallen back into sin. In other words, you're guilty. Retraction, a confession of guilt can mean guilt, but the retraction of the confession is definitely a sign of guilt. And so this was enough. This was enough. In 1314, 7 years after this incident, in 1314, Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master, the head of the Knights Templar, And remember that by this time, Jerusalem was gone, the Holy Land was gone. Oh, practically, the entire Crusader impulse was had disappeared. And there were, I mean, the maritime states, the commercial states, Pisa, Genoa, they had done deals with the Saracen, and trade didn't need an invasion anymore. And pilgrims were not obstructed from their pilgrimages to the Holy Land. So there really wasn't a purpose for these knights anymore. They were simply sitting on an entire mountain of gold and property in need of confiscation, or at least that was the plan in France. Jacques de Molay burnt at the stake. Shortly afterwards, the Pope, Clement V, died. And after that, the king, Philip the Fair, the king of France, thrown from a horse. Evidently the horse fell over. The king fell with the horse and died. And so that was the end of everybody involved, pretty much. Everybody involved in France. The French crown kept most of what they had. Some of it went to the Hospitallers, who still had a purpose, right? They had the island of Cyprus to themselves. But then from Cyprus to Rhodes, from Rhodes to Malta, the Hospitallers got a lot of that. As I mentioned yesterday, in Aragon, they didn't want to. They asked the Pope for his judgment. The Pope insisted. And so, yes, after a long time, after a siege, they were able to take over the last vestiges, the strongholds, in Aragon. And, well, in Portugal, the area of Tomar, the headquarters, all of that went to the Order of Christ, which was simply a rebranding of the Knights Templar. In Portugal, they were considered absolutely essential to the maintenance of the kingdom and extremely loyal. Now, in Aragon, a lot of their property went to the Order of Montesa, especially in Valencia. Montesa, the Aragonese version of Calatrava, very closely connected with the Order of the Knights of Calatrava, the Order of Montesa. And so, yes, a lot of the property went there. The king confiscated the land, confiscated their property, because civil confiscation by the crown of Aragon was considered the el mal menor, right? The lesser evil, better than ecclesiastical intervention and confiscation. The two last places, Castellote and Miravet, Miravet, lasted about a year under siege. And when they finally gave up, there were only a few people, only a symbolic number of people there. The rest had escaped. And so it was going to be necessary for them to reintegrate themselves into society, to rehabilitate themselves, or in disguise, to integrate themselves into other orders. In any case, that is the story of the Templars. They were accused of all kinds of things. Riding a horse two by two. Now, is that sodomy or is that economy? It sounds like economy to me. It sounds like two knights sharing one horse, two knights sharing one shield, all of that. It sounds like good economic reasons for that. And in addition, the accusation that they denied Christ, right? Negación de Cristo. Well, this could be an imitation of Peter, right? Saint Peter, you will deny me three times, right? The night of Gethsemane, you will deny me three times before the cock crows. Taken from the Bible, and this was a ritual that they may have practiced. They may. However, all of these charges were without merit. It was just a question of becoming too rich. All right, I have to take a break now. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
Ahora que tienes 22, quizá 23 años, a tu edad todavía no cuesta tanto hacerte con un alto nivel de inglés. Si no acometes este problema ahora, si te empeñas en esquivar el asunto haciendo un máster en empresas, que tampoco te va a diferenciar al final, te condenas a arrastrar el tema del idioma inglés hasta el fin de tu vida profesional. Si no agarras el tema del inglés ahora, con decisión y firmeza, no llegarás a saberlo nunca. Siempre tendrás un nivel medio. Infórmate, grupobaugan.com. Baugan presenta La Píldora del Inglés.
Contabilidad.
Accounting.
Informática.
IT. Information Technology.
Recursos humanos.
HR. Human Resources.
Ventas.
Sales.
Finanzas.
Finance.
Investigación y desarrollo.
R&D. Research and Development.
Operaciones.
Operations.
Atención al cliente.
Customer Services.
Debería hablar con alguien de finanzas.
He should speak to someone in finance.
Tom debería solicitar un trabajo en operaciones.
Tom should apply for a job in operations.
No deberían molestar al departamento en contabilidad. Están muy ocupados.
They shouldn't disturb the accounting department. They're very busy.
Ella debería hablar con el director de recursos humanos.
She should speak to the human resources manager.
Luis y Pedro deberían pedirle al departamento de I+D que lo haga.
Luis and Pedro should ask the R&D department to do it.
El departamento de informática debería poder ayudarte si tienes un problema con el nuevo sistema operativo.
The IT department should be able to help you if you have a problem with the new operating system.
Carmen trabaja en ventas, pero debería cambiarse al departamento de atención al cliente.
Carmen works in sales, but she should move to the customer services department.
No importa lo que hayas estudiado, no importa a qué te quieras dedicar. Hagas lo que hagas, vas a necesitar el inglés. Haz un máster que realmente merezca la pena. Haz el máster en inglés profesional de Baugan. Más información en el 91-133-5833 o en grupobaugan.com. Máster en inglés profesional.
Además, ahora financiate hasta el 100% del coste y págalo cómodamente hasta en 24 meses. Puedes ver las condiciones de financiación en el apartado de máster en grupobaugan.com.
Lo de mi hijo no es normal. Lleva 2 años en clase de inglés y sigue en el mismo nivel que cuando empezó. Desaparece durante 1 hora 3 veces a la semana y cuando vuelve es que no habla ni una palabra de inglés. Lo único que dice es, mamá, no quiero volver.
Si te siguen pasando estas Stranger Things con los cursos de inglés de tus hijos, es hora de salir de la oscuridad. Darles la oportunidad que tú no tuviste con Vaughan Jr. Un curso de inglés adaptado a su ritmo de aprendizaje, divertido y eficaz, con unos profesores únicos que les motivan y despiertan sus ganas de aprender. Date prisa antes de que desaparezcan las últimas plazas que nos quedan. Llama ahora al 91-133-5832 o entra en grupovaughan.com.
Empower your English. Empower yourself.
¿Qué es el inglés para tus hijos?
A los míos les encanta. Lo ven como un juego, una forma de comunicarse con sus amigos.
Pues el mío mayor se le da fatal. Mira que me pongo con él y nada. Si es que no le entran, los idiomas no son lo suyo.
La forma en la que les enseñan de pequeños les marcará toda la vida en su relación con el idioma. Por eso, en nuestro Club Junior somos muy conscientes de eso. Por eso, con nosotros, las niñas y los niños aprenden divirtiéndose. Adquieren el idioma de forma natural. Reciben una atención mucho más personalizada que la del colegio. Y en definitiva, acaban adorando el inglés. En el Club Junior de Vaughan damos clases en grupos reducidos desde los 4 hasta los 17 años. Si realmente te importa el inglés de tus hijos, solicita más información sobre el Club Junior en grupovaughan.com.
This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. On the first part of the program, I was speaking about the end of the Knights Templar, how all of that worked out in the end. And on the second part of the program, I'd like to go back to something. This is a suggestion from a listener. Remember that this is as much your program as mine, and I am open to suggestions by listeners. One of them contacted me and asked me to speak in greater detail about the Cathars and how the Cathars thought, what they actually believed, what made them special and what made them attractive, why so many people in Provence would bother listening to the Cathars in the first place and risk this kind of condemnation, this excommunication, papal excommunication, how they would risk this for an idea, for a theology. Well, remember that it was more than an idea. Naturally, people believed at the time that this was true. And in order to understand what they were talking about, we have to get into something called theodicy. Gottfried Leibniz in the 17th century, Leibniz, the philosopher, invented this term. He coined, acuñar. He coined the term theodicy, which in Spanish would be teodicea. It means sort of an apology for the fact that God, who is everywhere, that God allows a little space for evil in the world, for bad to happen. We all know cases in which good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. And the question is, why? Why does God allow this? Now, from the very beginning, you had Epicurus, right, back in the pre-Christian world, Epicurus saying that if you believe in a God that is omnibenevolent, all good, omnibenevolent, and at the same time omniscient, meaning all wise, somebody who knows everything, or omnipotent, if he's powerful, then you have a problem. Because if that were true, everything would be good. So, in other words, Epicurus used this as proof that God cannot be omnibenevolent, omniscient, and omnipotent. This is kind of a proof that that polytheism is a much better explanation for the existence of evil. Now, he said that, other people simply avoid the question. And this is also kind of legitimate, saying that God's the boss. Who am I? Right? Thinking that we are capable of understanding theodicy, thinking that we are that the mind is capable of second guessing, that would be the sin of pride. And you have that, especially in the Christian tradition, you have that all the way from Paul talking, he says, in Latin it's sapientiam sapientum perdam, which means I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. Meaning, people who think they know are fooling themselves. That is sin. And this, of course, was the justification for the destruction of, philosophy, of philosophical schools, reasoning, science, all of that. All of that is subject to faith. Faith comes first. That's the idea, at least. I mean, and this comes even before. I mean, from the Greek tradition, you have it. You have the idea of hubris. Hubris is this kind of arrogance that doesn't know its place. And so, in many of the Greek myths, you have somebody who thinks that he is as good as one of the gods, that he is in some way divine, that he is in some way really, really clever. Greeks, the ancient Greeks, they knew that they were clever. They knew that they were good. But you get case after case in mythology where they go too far and the gods descend and punish them. One of those cases, for example, Oedipus. There's the riddle of the Sphinx. And the Esfinge, the Sphinx, you know, what walks on four legs when it's small, what walks on two legs when it's an adult, what walks on three legs when it's old. And Oedipus says, why? A man. He solves the riddle of the Sphinx, and the Sphinx goes away. And Oedipus evidently commits the sin of hubris, thinks too much of himself. He is punished. Now, this defying of the gods, this arrogance, again, this idea from the Greek tradition as well as from Christianity, maybe Christianity got it from the Greeks, but I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. Anybody who thinks science or reason or rationality is the way to truth is simply fooling themselves. So that is one of the traditional ways of dealing with the existence of evil in the world. How do you even, how can you even think that you are capable of making that kind of judgment? On a more practical level, revealed doctrine, I mean, once it becomes orthodoxy, it has to be obeyed. You don't want it to be questioned. You don't want to look too closely. And so, yes, revealed doctrine, orthodoxy, tends to hide its own origin. This is true in every religion. You go back to the beginning and you don't find a lot of information because, well, Bismarck, right, the German chancellor, Bismarck said, the law is like a sausage. It tastes much better if you don't know how it was made. And that's true for sausage, and that's true for law, because many of the things that go into law are ugly. Many of the compromises that go into law are ugly. Well, much more so for orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is like a sausage. Don't question. Now, this theodicy, this idea of what kind of God would let bad things like this happen. Well, the Cathars simply avoid the question. They get out of it. The Cathars have an easy answer. That evil is not God. God is only good. Evil, this contamination, what Satan is doing, is just the opposite of God. And we live in a contaminated world, a polluted. Satan is everywhere. And so we are pretty much corrupt. And we should recognize that fact. However, God is love, God is the way out, and God will win in the end. This is very, very close to Zoroastrianism, to Manichaeism, to things that that were called heresy from the beginning, but here it was reasserted. It came into southern France. It came into Provence at the beginning of the 12th century, and immediately found a home. People liked the idea. I mean, compare it, for example, I don't know, the book of Job, right? In this Job, remember that Satan, the name Satan, el adversario, that's the name in Hebrew. Satan is actually part of God's inner circle, and an honored member, and he is like a lieutenant of God. So yes, the Satan is God's lieutenant, and does the things that God wants him to do. Now, that is not easy to explain, and the book of Job is not easy to explain. Now, to make it even simpler, the Cathars had this happy end of times. So yes, God will triumph in the end, and everybody will be happy, and the afterlife will be happy. The whole resolution is going to be good. Bad will be eliminated. Now, this is obviously attractive because the alternative at the time, in the Middle Ages, this idea that Catholicism was that that your soul is at risk, that you have to choose, and you have to choose well, because you can spend eternity in damnation. Now, obviously, it was condemned. It was condemned from the beginning. And Santo Domingo, Domingo de Guzmán, coming all the way from Castile, He believed in argumentation. He believed in, well, doing what the Cathars were doing, because they were not ostentatious. They were frugal. They were abstemious. They were chaste, right? Castos. Their preaching was low-key. They would talk to anyone, low or high. That's one of the things that made them so attractive, was this lack of pretension, lack of ostentation, and that was the key to their success. Well, emulating this, Domingo de Guzmán, well, argumentation, simple life, poverty. This was the basis of the foundation of the Dominican order. The argument he used would be the standard argument that evil is the absence of good. Evil is the omissio boni, that's what it's called. The light is a thing. Darkness is not a thing. Darkness is the absence of light. Darkness does not extend itself. Darkness does not project. Darkness disappears any time there's light. So this is a relatively simple argument. And unfortunately, it didn't convince. Unfortunately, they were not successful. And you had to use the stick, right? There's always the carrot and the stick, zanahoria y palo. And you had to start burning people and destroying things. And it was going to be necessary to come down. The papal envoy, the ambassador, the legate, Pierre de Castelnau, he was interviewing with Raymond VI, the Count of Toulouse, who was pretty much in charge of the area that had been infiltrated, let's put it that way, by Cathars. He came back from this negotiation. He was crossing over the Rhone River, El Ródano, crossing over the Rhone, and he was killed. And of course, Raymond, directly or indirectly, was responsible. And the Pope, Innocent III, directed the crusade pretty much personally against Raymond. Now, part of the crusade was you must proceed to destroy this heresy, right? Inocencio III, he no tenía pelos en la lengua, right? He spoke his mind. He said, proceed to destroy this heresy with all the means that God inspires in you. In other words, they had carte blanche. They had free rein, rienda suelta. They could do whatever they wanted. Now, I mentioned on an earlier program that there was this geographical geopolitical sort of thing where the north, right, France, the Île-de-France, the French kingdom, finally got its chance to completely destroy and crush the south. The south, Provence, which had been more sophisticated, richer, culturally much better. I mean, the north was a cow town when Provence was the home to the troubadours. Well, this was revenge. The north gets to demolish the south, and the south never rose again. After that, the south was desolate. In addition to which, the Cathars were very popular among the new commercial class, among people, you know, that were people that were forming in trades and so forth. And English just doesn't have a good word for burgueses. You know, we because of the influence of Karl Marx, we go into French. We call them bourgeois, but that's not English. The English equivalent, Burgess, nobody uses that. When you talk about the Burgesses, you're talking about something from the 18th century, 17th century. The Burgesses, that doesn't work either. And so we really don't have an adequate term for this new bourgeoisie, for this new commercial class that is growing up around the cities mostly. We've seen it before. I mean, in Spain, it happened during the creation of the Camino de Santiago. These places began to fill with these new people, which were not part of the feudal order. And we saw the civil disturbances that happened when they wanted more power, right? The practical destruction of the city of Sahagún, or when Queen Urraca and the creator of the Cathedral of Santiago, Diego de Gelmed, when they were trapped in a tower with all of these burgueses below that wanted their blood. So, yes, it was happening in the north of Spain. Obviously, Spain was late for this. During the Reconquista, right, many of the artisans, many of the commercial class, many of the people who would be burgueses were, in fact, Moors, and that's where you get Mudéjar art. I mean, the owners were Christian, but the workers were not. And the workers were not in a position to organize into gremios or the things that were going to cause so many disturbances in Germany or France or England. So, yes, Spain was kind of exempt from that, especially in the south. But in France, and especially in Provence, it was very important at this time. And this was a way for the feudal system to reassert its power. They asked, give up your people. The answer was, we will never give up our own people. And so, the papal envoy, the Bishop Arnaldo Amalarico, he said, Matalos a todos que Dios reconocerá los suyos, right? That's attributed to him initially. I imagine he was not the first person to say this, but this is normally attributed to him. Kill them all, God will know his own. And this is exceptionally important because you've got the King of Aragon. You've got Pere Segon. You've got Peter II. His wife was Maria de Montpellier. And that's Raymond of Toulouse's sister. That means he's got lots of land interests in the north. And so he's got family in the north. Toulouse is a vassal of the Kingdom of Aragon, and he's going to protect his vassal. At the same time, Peter is a vassal of the Pope, which Peter was the first Aragonese king. Aragon was a vassal state of the papacy, and he was the first to be crowned by the Pope. And so here he is going against, as a vassal, going against his lord, to defend his own vassal. He participated in Navas de Tolosa. When he came back from Navas de Tolosa, he discovered that Toulouse had been taken. Immediately, he went up north to defend his own interests. And he went with his brother-in-law, with the chief instigator, with the one that the whole Inquisition, or rather, I'm sorry, the whole crusade was directed against, with Raymond of Toulouse. They went to Muret. Raymond told Peter not to participate, but Peter didn't listen. He was temerario, he was reckless, and he was killed. And this death, naturally, it changes everything. It changes the course of history of Aragon and Catalonia. Remember, they're united. And it changes the destiny of France. As I say, the South will never rise again. At this time, Maria de Montpellier, by the way, he repudiated her as soon as he could. What he wanted was to marry the Queen of Jerusalem, and so he could have some kind of claim to Outremer. But no, he didn't do that. That didn't happen. He simply repudiated Marie of Montpellier. And, well, they had a son. This son is going to be Jaume I, the conqueridor, right? The conqueror, James the First, practically created the Catalan language. He wrote down his everything he did in Catalan, and the Llibre de Consolat de Mar, the rule book for international commerce, that was also written in Catalan. Now, he was raised in a castle by his enemy, Simon de Montfort. And, well, all of this, again, a complete different, a change, a turning point, punto de inflexión, in Spanish history and in French history, because Peter II was killed in the Battle of Muret. All right, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next one.
Los cursos intensivos de verano de Vaughan son diferentes a otros cursos intensivos de verano. En nuestros cursos intensivos de verano, nosotros no metemos entre 10 y 12 alumnos en cada clase. Nosotros tenemos un máximo de 6 alumnos por clase. En nuestros cursos intensivos de verano, no somos rígidos, somos flexibles. Puedes hacer un curso de 1, 2, 3 o 4 semanas, como tú decidas.
Entra en grupovaughan.com.
Ask me if I still exaggerate.
Do you still exaggerate?
Yes, I do. But I always exaggerate the truth. You understand?
Yeah.
You know, the teachers in Bowen are the best teachers in the world. But it's true. It's true.
You're right.
I mean, it's absolutely true. I mean, I'm sure there are a few teachers in Tokyo or in Buenos Aires who are outstanding teachers. But per language school, there are one or two. Here we have 300. It's just outstanding. On a scale of 1 to 10, we have quality 8, 9, and 10. And the average quality in the